Hi, my friends who listen to Future Primitive. Today, our guest is Janelle Hardy. She's a writer, an artist, a host of personal myth-making podcasts, and the creator teacher of a 5-month transformational memoir course. She's born and raised a Yukoner, a solo mother who has been working as a trauma-informed body worker in the hands-on healing arts fields for 13 years and as an artist for 17 years. She's taught adults out of her living room, art centers, universities, and community college. For the past 4 years, she's integrated all of her expertise, including a BA in anthropology, an MA in dance, and a diploma in structural integration into supporting people in their creative healing work via the alchemy of transformational memoir writing. Well, that's very interesting because I have actually written a memoir, and so I'm very interested in finding out what your particular approach to motivating people is.
Oh, yes, that's such an interesting question, and I'm actually dying to know how it was for you writing your memoir. So it's a big question and a small question. I think I narrow my focus to the generative part of memoir writing, so I support people in getting it out onto paper to the point of their first draft. I don't teach what comes after the first draft, which is a whole other body of work of editing and refining and thinking about publication or who you're going to share it with. But I very much focus on supporting people in moving past having the idea of writing down their life story and working with their life story and moving into actually doing it, which for many people, and especially the people I work with, it requires a lot of support, because one of the things I find that stops people from working with their life story, often for over 20 years, I have people confess that they've held this dream of writing their memoirs and pursuing a healing path for that long and have not done it. And one of the reasons I think that people hold on to such a deep, beautiful dream, transformative dream, and don't do it is because of the fear of being overwhelmed by painful memories, or just a big, rich life, not even knowing where to start. So that's my main focus, is supporting the healing process of writing stories down, revisiting memories, and also moving through all of the resistance that stops all of us, myself included, with creative projects, all the different kinds of resistance that stops people from doing what their heart and soul really desires.
So we're all living to know what is it that breaks through resistance?
There's so many different things. What about you, Joanna? Did you have resistance, actually? Or did it just flow?
Well, it took me 35 years And I started writing immediately after. I mean, there was definitely a particular story I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I started telling it immediately. And now I understand that there are many layers to memory.
Mm-hmm.
Memory is like erosion on a mountain. It has all of these extraordinary crevices and peaks and abysses, and it changes with time, and things that were important at some point are less important. Or so the reason it took me 35 years is that it took me that amount of years to love myself enough to believe in the authenticity of what I was writing. And that's what I wanted to convey.
Mm-hmm. I just got shivers all over my body when you said that. I think that is one of the reasons people wait, is needing to come to a point of believing and loving enough in themselves to start that process. Thanks for sharing that. I haven't actually heard it phrased that way before. And then to answer your question about what is it that causes people to like finally move out of resistance and into doing, I think actually pain is a great motivator. And sometimes it takes that, and I don't mean just physical pain, but emotional or mental pain, or the pain of holding it in and suppressing and shutting down the desire to create and express and explore and heal. At some point, for many people, that becomes far more uncomfortable than the discomfort of writing and potential embarrassment and awkwardness and all the things that come with learning how to write for some, or doing bad writing if you're a professional writer. Sometimes that stops people.
Mm-hmm.
But it often takes just being so uncomfortable finally that the push is, oh my gosh, I might feel better if I just let it out instead of holding it in. So that is one big stopping point. And then I think there is a softening that comes as we age around perfectionism, being less precious about our stories and less rigid about our ideas. And I've certainly noticed in myself, I really, really like getting older because I'm letting go of these ideas of having to have things be perfect, and that can really stop people. The idea is so magnificent that the reality of clumsy, awkward writing is painful enough to stop people for a while. And thank goodness that can shift, that we can be less precious and perfect about our process. And sometimes life circumstances change, and suddenly there's room to explore there. You know, if people have children and partners, and the children grow up and move away, or partnerships end, and there's all of this time and energy available suddenly, especially I've noticed for women.
So you talk about, you say, I'm bursting my heart every day. Can you say what that looks like, what that means?
Oh, okay.
How you do that, how you live that, how you share that.
It's an expansion and a contraction, I think. I find I'll contract into forgetting that the world is so beautiful and that people are so wonderful. And then I'll do the things that support my heart bursting, like walking outside. It's really quite simple, these are things I didn't want to accept when I was younger as being capable of being transcendent, but just walking for 20 minutes and looking around and noticing how the trees are changing each day as the seasons change. It's just incredible. My daughter, when she gets exuberant and sassy, and I had a moment last night where I looked at her and she was being that way, and my heart burst as much out of love and joy as out of absolute shock and astonishment. Mm-hmm. How did this human being who's bigger than me now ever come from me? It's so incredible when I make space to pause and just attend to my surroundings and notice. So,
the wonder.
Mm-hmm. And my students they help me have a bursting heart as well, to be able to be witness to people finding their way into deeper relationship with themselves, and the grief and the anger and the incredible joy that they get to experience and express because of that. It really makes my heart burst.
It's beautiful work. Relationship is beautiful work. Beautiful. Scary.
Yeah.
Infernal. Scary. Heavenly work. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, personal myth-making. What's that?
Mm-hmm. It's a phrase that came to me, and it's the name of my transformational memoir writing course, The Art of Personal Mythmaking. But I think it just kind of encapsulates my own personal process, which I so love supporting in other people, of discovering the mythologies that we've been raised in, and unraveling them and rewriting them into a healthier form. So if I use an example from my own...
Yes, yes.
My own life.
Examples.
Yeah, examples are so great. Growing up, there was this big mythology in my family, my mom's side of the family, of the amazing MacKinnons, and just like this idea of amazingness, and yet kind of under the surface of that, as I was growing up, I had so many questions, right? Of, well, if we're so amazing, why are so many of my aunts and uncles struggling with addictions? If we're so amazing, why, where is my family? How come there's been such a severing of ties to my mom's parents' extended family? The mythology was incongruent to what I noticed as the lived experience of my MacKinnon family members, and all of this mythologizing about these amazing Scottish ancestors. But it was just this foggy, abstract idea. Meanwhile, we're in northwestern Canada. Mm-hmm. We're certainly not Scottish. We're far removed from being Scottish, and we're not only Scottish. But again, the questioning, as I noticed and wondered and tried to make sense of the mythic imagination of my family and the realities, has really propelled me throughout my life trying to understand why there's an incongruence. And the more I dig and question, the more rabbit holes I go down, but the more clarity and understanding I get about all of the unsaid things.
Well, were your parents and grandparents connected to the earth?
No, I don't think they were.
Right.
No.
Right, right. So,
although, you know, it's interesting, I've always been touched by how my father describes his grandmother, who came from Welsh ancestors and gardened and loved the earth. That's the only ancestor I know of who was connected to the earth.
Yeah, because I am suspicious that most trauma comes from us being disconnected from the sensuous.
Mm-hmm.
And the sensuous is very connected to the land.
Yeah, I do. And in all of this, the questioning has led to, well, you know, what all these disconnections, you know, like the impacts of colonialism and these strange threads of not belonging but claiming ownership, these ways of existing in the world where we think we own the land. And I agree, the sensuous is really stripped out of it, especially my mom's side of the family comes from a Catholic background. And although I think it's very sensuous, the architecture and the iconography, the allowing humans to be sensuous and to actually be in their bodies, that is somehow so taboo. And I'm speaking as not as someone who went to church, but I went to a Catholic school, and just, you know, these multi-generational inheritances of patterns, and especially the non-verbal and the embodied patterns of lingering belief systems that are never articulated or voiced, but we feel them so intensely. And one of the things I think has been in my own family history has been very dangerous is actually to be sensuous and to be embodied and to be beautiful and to have pleasure in the world.
So you're a dancer.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I am one now, but I've done a lot of dance and it's my most favorite thing in the world.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And, mm-hmm.
That's your connection.
Yeah, into my body. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you speak about body support for writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting.
Yes. Oh, I love it. What do you want to know about body support for writing?
How do you offer that? What are your gifts from that place?
I offer my gifts, I think, are having learned how to be in my body and reclaim my body as my guide. And then having worked hands-on with people for 13 years, culturally, and I'm speaking from the perspective of kind of a Western, white, North American culture, we're taught from such a young age to not be in our body, to consider it as shameful, to consider it as less than the mind. And so it takes a lot of relearning to actually be in the body and allow the body to guide us for most people, not for everyone. Some people manage to keep that connection. But so I always start with our bodies for writing. and for healing. And so in my writing circles, in my course, our first writing prompt is always body-based. It's always something gentle that invites people to locate their consciousness, their awareness, and then to draw it into the body, to move that attention and awareness towards physical sensation and the sensuous, to just get a little practice shifting out of the brain and into the senses and the body, and then from that place start flow writing, and from that place do the writing prompts. And I feel like when we invite our bodies into a creative process and a memoir writing process, we get like 80% more, because our bodies hold things for us. And the more we can re-regulate our nervous system and release trauma, the more we can tune into our senses, the more receptive we are to what our body has been often trying to tell us for years or decades, the more three-dimensional our experiences and often even our memories and our ability to describe our experiences becomes richer when we invite all of that back in.
Talk to me about you. Talk to me about your growth and how all this experience, teaching and healing, what's your journey in this? How has it transformed you? What have you discovered spiritually?
I just have to sit with that for a second.
Take your time.
I think there's like two journeys. One is the journey of my own self-discovery and self-healing to the point where this personal myth-making work showed up to me. And then there's the journey from that point onwards. Which one did you want me to speak to?
Sounds really interesting. So I know one of the points that it starts from is hearing your grandfather play the fiddle.
How do you know that? my mom grew up in poverty, and her father, part of the reason was he was an alcoholic. He didn't really hold down a job and contribute to taking care of his eight children. But he did build this house out of a lot of excess material from when the American Army put the Alaska Highway through the Yukon into Alaska. And so it was a house. It wasn't a total shack, because in the kind of extreme cold that you get in the Yukon, no one would survive in a literal shack. But it wasn't much. And so then my parents, when I was young, they bought the house off of my grandma. My mom's dad was already passed on, and my dad's a carpenter as well. And so they were doing renovations, but this one corner of the house always stayed the same. And I do remember the house that my grandfather built before the renovations happened. And my memory is that my grandfather, who was Celtic Cape Bretoner, so his first language was Gaelic, and he played the fiddle by ear. This was just what these Scottish descendants in Nova Scotia did. He would come and he would play the fiddle when I was little. And I always remembered that. And then one day I said to my mother, he'd stopped coming. And I said, how come Grandpa's not coming and playing fiddle anymore? And she gave me the strangest look. And She quizzed me about what did he look like, what was he doing, where did he stand. And so I remembered it was he was often wearing a red and black plaid wool shirt coat, like a thicker wool shirt mm-hmm. that you can wear as a coat. Mm-hmm. He always stood in the corner of the living room that was the outside corner wall of the house between the two windows. He always played the fiddle. And I don't really remember other people being there, but I just had a general memory that he was coming to play the fiddle for everyone. And as it turns out, he had actually died when my mom was 12. So he wasn't ever alive when I was born. But my memory, even now telling the story, is so strongly that I had an experience with my grandfather coming and playing the fiddle for me when I was a child, that it's hard to believe that he died, 6 years before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's marked your life.
That I think that was part of the questioning was my memory of my grandfather was of this very loving man playing beautiful Scottish music, fiddle music, and then learning that he was an alcoholic, that he was abusive, that he wasn't very functional, which is in part a legacy of being a teenage soldier before PTSD and counseling and was ever offered. So all of these young men coming back from the war, self-medicated with alcohol, but learning all of these things and like really struggling to reconcile how can someone be so many different things and how can the damage that they endured, how do I deal with the heartbreak of seeing how difficult he made his children's lives, seeing my aunts and uncles and some of my cousins struggle, it really propelled me to understand healing and trauma and multi-generational legacies like that.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that when he was in Scotland, he was close to the earth?
Oh, well, he wasn't from Scotland. He was from Nova Scotia in Canada, but very closely tied to the Scottish culture and ancestry. A lot of what happened with Scottish people that ended up in Nova Scotia on the eastern side of Canada was that they held on so tightly to their culture and their language, which he didn't pass on, by the way. So that was another kind of like grief, this simmering grief of he came from these incredible cultural heritages and he never spoke his language to his children and he never played music with them or taught them.
Right, right. The mm-hmm. the outsider. Perhaps that's why you have such a gift for bringing people in.
Yeah, so I guess I have some things to thank my grandfather for, Joanna. This is such an interesting conversation we're having.
Oh, good, good. So I love what you write about and you say about building a house was one of the greatest life experiences you've had.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, and for anyone listening, I have it's a very long essay I wrote about what building a house, working in carpentry has taught me about the healing process and becoming whole. And so I come from a lineage of carpenters because my mother's father was a carpenter. My dad's a carpenter. Both my brothers are carpenters.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up around, it's kind of the story of the cobbler's children are always barefoot. Ah. Growing up with a carpenter father means your house is never finished.
Oh, I see.
It's always in mid-renovation, but.
Right.
So I grew up in a home that half of the things you see in a finished home, I saw the exposed innards and like going upstairs and a ladder instead of stairs.
Oh.
My dad didn't build the stairs after he put the second floor on for years. I always enjoyed doing little building projects with my dad as a child. Like we built a fort together. And so I did spend about a year and a half working as an apprentice carpenter. It takes so many years to become truly skilled. I cannot claim to be a carpenter, but one of the absolutely incredible things about doing carpentry work is learning to make constant mistakes and be okay with it. And ooh. I think this actually really taught me to get past my own perfectionism, because when you're building an enormous project, it's just not possible to get everything right all the time. And the bigger lesson is actually resilience, that you make mistakes, you figure it out, you fix it, and you keep going. You never let that stop you. And you ask for help, right? You've always got more experienced people around. You do your research, you ask for the tips and tricks to fix it and do better next time, and you just keep going. Lessons around foundations and how important it is to be in right relationship with gravity. And if you don't start right, it doesn't matter how beautiful you build, it's going to fall apart if it's not in alignment, if it's not lined up. There's so many metaphors for these lessons around building. And another really big one for me was every single thing is touched. Anytime you're in a building, everything is touched, including the insides of the house. Human hands are touching everything in order to put it together. And there's thought, particularly if the builders are really skilled and really care about their craftsmanship or craftspersonship, you can just count on looking around and knowing that the touch and care that went into creating the space that you're in is astronomical, unless you've actually physically done that kind of work. You just actually can't even imagine. And so with ourselves and our own healing and our own growth and our own creative work, don't we deserve to bring that level of attention and care to ourselves as well?
Ah, yes, yes, yes. And you sparked this thought for me, like growing a child, and by the time the child gets to be a teenager, they've been touched in every way possible. They've been hopefully respectfully touched in every way possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, raising kids requires that level of regard and care too. And I think what we often forget is that we can bring that to ourselves.
Great. Yeah. So how do we build ourselves?
Well, I think the reason I really like working with memoir, with life stories, is that we don't have to find any magic solutions. All we really need to do is to turn our gaze inwards and look at ourselves and who and what we come from, and really take a bigger picture, not just, you know, our own one life, but all of the paths and steps that our ancestors took that led us to the point of where we are, and how that shapes us as well, and how we have an opportunity to look and heal the painful parts of it, but we also have the opportunity, which I think is so important in these hyper individualistic, like do it yourself lone cowboy sort of ideologies is we can also go, and what are the gifts that we've received from the cultural backgrounds and from the ancestors that we have, and how can we actually receive that support and lean on that as well as we look at our at building ourselves up. We're not just standing on air. We actually do have a foundation of who came before us that we can tap into. And I actually love working with fairy tales for that reason too, because in an even broader way, we can go and what are the tremendous cultural inheritances that have lasted for thousands of years that I can also draw on. These stories that keep getting passed down exist for a reason and are bigger and richer than they seem.
So, what's your favorite fairy tale?
Well, I'm really enamored and have been for a while with the Selkie mythology, the seal woman fairy tale from Celtic lore.
Oh, would you tell it?
Okay. I'm going to tell whatever version shows up right now.
Okay, great. And, that's how it is.
Yeah, okay. Once upon a time, and this is a time that could be any time at all, but it was and is once upon a time. There were seal women who loved, absolutely loved, the cold saltwater sea and the jagged rocks and diving deep, 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 deep down into the bottom of the ocean. And also occasionally, once upon a time for them, they would swim to one of the rocks near the shore when the sun was shining bright, and they would lollop themselves onto the rock in the ways that seals awkwardly move on land, and then they would strip out of their seal skins and emerge as these naked, beautiful women. And they would sun themselves, and they would laugh, and they would eat raw fish, as seals do, and they would just have the best time ever. And it so happened that once upon a time, near one of these boulders near the shore of the cold saltwater sea, there was a very lonely young fisherman who lived by himself in a stone house. And no one knows why he wasn't living in the village that was a half a day's walk away. But it was the case that he lived by himself, and his heart was so lonely. And he would go fishing every couple of days, and he had a life that was supported in terms of food. But he had no one, and he was lonely. And he would hear this laughter every once in a while, and he discovered that these seals that frolicked about sometimes shed their skins and became beautiful, beautiful naked women, and they were so close to him, and he got in the habit of watching and listening and then gazing upon them from the shore. And one day he had the idea to steal a seal skin, and so he did. He swam quietly over to the boulder, and he pulled one of the sealskins just gently and quietly off, and then he swam back to shore, and he hid that sealskin in a little tiny cave close to the shore, and he pushed a big boulder in front of it. And then he went back to the edge, and he watched as the sun got a little dimmer, and all of the women went and they pulled on their sealskins and they jumped back into the water, but one of them couldn't. She searched and she searched, but she couldn't find her sealskin. Mm. And she started to cry, and her sisters barked their seal barks from the water at her, but there was nothing to be done. She had no sealskin. She could not return to the sea. So off the seal sisters went. And this is when the lonely fisherman revealed himself. And he told her he had her sealskin. and she raged at him. And he told her how lonely he was and how beautiful he found her to be. And she said it was none of her business that he was lonely, mm-hmm. and to give her back her sealskin and leave her alone. But he wouldn't, and so she was trapped. They came up with an agreement that she would go to land with him and she would marry him. She'd have children with him, and she would do this for 7 years, and she would do it setting aside her anger and her resentment, because at the end of the 7 years, he would return her sealskin to her and she would return to the sea. And so the agreement was made, and they both swam to shore and to his stone house and made a life together. And this fisherman, well, he was so happy because he had this beautiful seal woman with him, and he wasn't lonely anymore. And she was not very happy, but she'd seen that the agreement was to be made, and so she made the best of it. And when she had her first child, she thought, well, this is something new. And this child comes from this man, and I love this child. And then she had another child, maybe two or three more, who knows? Mm-hmm. And the years marched on, and the children got bigger. And each year she just lost a little bit more of her vitality, where she used to sing and dance, and she used to really relish discovering this land above the water and the plants and learning to cook and speaking to birds and just all sorts of experiences she was having. She was really making the best of it, but she was losing her vitality. She was losing her voice. She was losing the energy to dance. And no one really noticed because it was incremental. But her skin was getting drier, and she was really looking a lot older than her age because she was drying up. And then the 7 years came, and she told her husband it was time to return her sealskin to her. And he broke their agreement. He refused. And he went off in his fishing boat, and he knew what he was doing was wrong, but he loved her so much, and he'd gotten so attached to this idea that he could take her sealskin, and then she would fall in love with him and have kids, and she'd never want to leave. And although he knew what he was doing was wrong, he still wouldn't return the sealskin to her. And she really started to decline, because seal women can only live for so long out of the water. And 7 years was her limit. But her children noticed, and they started to worry and wonder. And it so happened that her eldest child was a real explorer and loved the rocks and the shoreline and really just discovering. And this child had come across just a bit of a crack. And that was a tiny little cave. And there's this great big boulder in front of it. And peering in, just one eyeball looking in with the shaft of light shining above through the crack, this child saw a sealskin and thought that was very, very strange. Of course, the children didn't know the story of how their parents became parents together and married. And so the child ran home and said, Mom, guess what I saw? I saw this fur in this cave. And the mom, suddenly the color came back to her and her cheeks flushed and she looked ferocious and she snarled, "Where is it?" And the child got scared but led the mother to the cave because, well, when your mom gets fierce like that, you do what she asks. And with this incredible superhuman strength, when the mother peered through that crack and saw her sealskin, she shoved that huge boulder aside, which her husband had just barely managed to lodge in front of the hole when he took it those 7.5 years ago. She shoved that boulder aside and she grabbed her sealskin and wrapped it to her, and she ran to the edge of the shore and she let out these strange barking noises that scared her 7-year-old even more. So the 7-year-old, that child was crying behind her and watching as the mother jumped into that sealskin after stripping off her clothes, stripping naked, and rolled herself into the water, and before her child's eyes transformed into a seal. And then behind her, suddenly there's this chorus of barking, and all of her sister seals are there. And off they swam. But of course, the mother, the seal woman, she was a mother, and she swam away, and then she felt torn, and she swam back, and she swam away with her sisters, and she swam back to her child. Oh, what a tough, tough thing. And she lolloped herself back up onto the shore, and she stripped down some of that sealskin so her child could see that it was her, and she started to tell a story about how she wasn't just human, she was also seal. And that meant that her child was also seal, and that she had to return to the water, and she knew that it would hurt her child, but this was what she had to do, but not to worry, she would be able to visit. And so the mother, the seal woman, returned to the sea with her sister seals, but she very often came to the shore to visit with her children. And she very often sunbathed on the boulder. And she was never bothered again by the sailor who, heartbroken and stricken and guilt-ridden, continued to raise their children and never did try to steal that sealskin again. And that is the end of the story for now.
Okay. We have a few minutes left, and I just would like you to close by telling us briefly what this means to you.
For me, what it means, what it has meant for a long time, yes, was a self-reclamation of my true nature. And I first took this version of understanding the story from Clarissa Pinkola Estes's examination of the Selkie story in her book Women Who Run with the Wolves, about how having the sealskin stolen and then discovering it, putting it back on and returning to the sea is can be understood as having lost yourself, the skin and the part of you, the part of me that is essential to my nature that I had denied and shoved away and put aside. And so I know that to be true about myself, that I'd really tried to conform to societal ideas of how I should be, and that a lot of my own spiritual healing path has been understanding myself and my nature and reclaiming that. So I like to think of like putting on my own sealskin and all the blubber of it as understanding that I'm a really sensitive person, and understanding that there's ways I have to really care for myself and own my sensitivity rather than trying to deny it and not be as sensitive as I am, and just really like inhabit this blubbery, smooth, silky sealskin of being a sensitive person, and in the process of doing that, feeling less knocked off kilter. So that exploration has been of service to me for so long, and I think I still love the story, and I'm kind of in the middle of understanding it differently. So I can't give you the answer to how I'm understanding it now, but there's something about thinking of the child as the gift of two opposite natures that is torn between the two lands, but also able to navigate and move between the two lands, the two worlds, or the sea and the land. That as a metaphor, I think, is working with my soul right now. The child that gets left behind by the mother.
Right. Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. And good love, good growth, good work. All the best to you.
Well, thank you, Joanna. And thank you for this wonderful treat of being interviewed by you. It's been very illuminating.
Good.